All right, so this is October 10th, and we are about to launch into the next block of the course on class. I had said at the end of the last lecture that I would say some additional things on the historical trajectory of capitalism analysis proposed by Giovanni Arrighi. I think it's actually better for us just to begin our new section on class and leave that previous material behind. Let me just say one or two just really short things about how to think about the Arrighi work, since I know for sure that some of you will be continuing to do work on global capitalist themes and themes about capitalist development. Arrighi's work is not broadly accepted as a kind of definitive statement about how to think about the overall trajectory of capitalism and what its future prospects hold. One of the really distinctive things about the books is its boldness in actually talking about possible futures. You don't see people willing to stick their necks out that much on such things. And at the end of the book, he has these three scenarios of possible futures. It's not so much that any of them have full credibility as possibilities. They're not fleshed out enough. But they do indicate the kind of future logics that one might think are imminent in the present situation. The other thing that's really distinctive about Arrighi in the context of the immediate worries in the political economy, about policy, about what to do, there's a tendency to regard this current financial crisis as being generated by very special current problems, right? Failures of bank regulation, particular things that happened in the United States with respect to the Fed and other kinds of agencies, all of this sort of stuff. One of the messages of Arrighi is that this is a recurrent pattern, that there are these very long waves of capitalist development, all of which culminate in financial turbulence and crisis. And that financial turbulence and crisis always occurs at the end of an extended period of financialization. And that extended period of financialization is set off by what he calls a signal crisis, a form of stagnation that the dominant power of accumulation hits. So when the U.S.-led accumulation regime hits this stagnation period beginning in the 70s, and people are puzzling, what the hell's going on? Is this that labor is too strong? What's happening? There's not a realization that that also happened in the British accumulation regime in the 1870s. That was the signal crisis in Britain. And that each of these was followed by a period of deep financialization, which culminates in an extended period of turbulence, during which there's a shift of the center of gravity of accumulation from the old hegemonic bloc to a new one, and conditions for sustained, stable material accumulation then get set in motion again. So that is a perspective that is almost completely absent from the current discussion. This is all seen as something special to the current situation, which, of course, there are specificities. And I think the Arrighi book is a very provocative and interesting one to ponder and think about. I also offered it in the syllabus as a way of showing a very creative and interesting set of efforts to produce a theory of the history of capitalism's future, given the unsatisfactory character of the classic theory. So it's not so much that it is itself a satisfactory alternative, but it's meant to illustrate a way of continuing that tradition of work alive. Now we're going to set all that stuff apart, and we're embarking on a whole new adventure. The next two parts of the course all center around the concept of class in different ways. I've broken it into two pieces, class structure and class formation. I think of those as the kind of two master concepts to define different agendas. The concept of class struggle figures in both of them. So it's not that class structure is a discussion of structural realities and class formation is a study of dynamic human beings engaging the world in struggles. Class struggle figures in both, as we will see. Both the study of class structure and the study of class formation focus on the structural features of these problems as they are interconnected with struggles and practices in both cases. But this will all become hopefully clear as we go on. Just want to be sure this time we are actually, yes, we are having recording. The first session is meant to deal with the kind of biggest overarching question, what is class? This discussion is also, I think, a good context for thinking about some very general methodological questions in social theory, namely the problem of what does it mean to worry about a concept? We are engaged in a discussion of concept formation in this particular lecture. I think I've mentioned this contrast before, but I'll do it again just to get this really clearly on the table. Theoretical work, I think, can be divided into two sorts of discussions that I would refer to as concept formation, and discussions that could be called theory construction. Concepts and theories. Concepts involve defining the terms that you use in theories. Theories involve using these terms to build arguments. Arguments, especially in social science, that are arguments around explaining things. What theories do is explain how things work. They explain things. To explain things, you need terms. The terms are concepts. Now, there is a deep interconnection between the task of concept formation and theory construction. You can't build theories without concepts. It's just ridiculous. You can't possibly do it. But the concepts get their meanings from the theories in which they function. So you really can't define concepts without having theories. This is the classic problem of language in general. You know, language is built up of words, but the words can only be defined in terms of other words. There are some words that can be defined by pictures, you know. You can define the word cow by showing a picture of a cow. You don't have to say anything about it. But in general, language, the definitions of specific words depends upon other words. So that's kind of like the meaning of concepts depends upon the theories in which they function. This makes this a delicate matter, right? You can't really give full-blown definitions of concepts that make any sense unless you already have some idea of how they are going to function in explanations and theoretical frameworks. But you can't even begin laying out theoretical frameworks without having the concepts you use to build them. That's why in this class in general, and in this discussion of class in particular, there is a kind of iterative process. You define concepts initially to kind of get the lay of the land, to get your building blocks. You then use them in various kinds of explanatory tasks to understand different specific kinds of phenomena. And in the course of doing that, the real meaning of the initial specifications becomes clarified. It's also the case that in using your concepts and theories, you discover inadequacies in the concepts. Now, think of concepts as a kind of menu. You've got this repertoire or menu of concepts. You then want to get on with the business of explaining things. You try to do it, and things just aren't working well. And it's often very difficult to diagnose. Is the problem that I don't really have the necessary concepts I need to explain the things I want to explain? Or is it there's something just wrong in my explanations? I'm just not thinking through the causal processes, the contingencies, the non-linearities, the complexities, the interactions. The concept of class is really a good one for that, to kind of figure it. You have a concept of class, it fails in its explanatory purposes. Is this because there's some flaw in the concept of class and we need to retool it? Or is it because the explanatory context actually has other forms of complexity in play? Is the reason why, if you're using the concept of class to try to explain class conflict in the United States in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and you're repeatedly not being able to produce very compelling explanations of collective action and class consciousness in the United States, is it because really you're putting too much of a burden on the concept of class to do that explanatory work, and you need to add non-class concepts, let's say race, or let's say culture, you know, American traditions of various sorts, and that it's really not a problem with the concept of class, the concept of class you have is perfectly fine, or is the problem actually that you're not using a good enough, a well thought through enough concept of class? Now, this is how I got actually into the class concept business, as it were. The sort of biography around my preoccupation was this, that as a graduate student in Berkeley, I was basically wanting not to study class especially. I wanted to work on Marxist problems in a way that would convince sociology that Marxism had to be taken seriously as a serious contender for sociological research, not as a fringe tradition that simply complained, you know, about how bourgeois sociology was. I wanted to wage battle with the mainstream using Marxian concepts. And I wanted to do so in a way that would be credible. So I thought, well, the way to do it is to bring Marxist concepts onto the quantitative terrain of mainstream sociology. And the decision to focus on class specifically was both because it's obviously a very central concept within Marxism. So if you can establish the importance of Marxian understandings of class, you've done a lot to establish the importance of Marxism. But it was also, it seemed, an especially amenable set of categories to bring right onto the into the heart of quantitative sociology. So I had, that was the objective. The problem that I immediately encountered was that there were all sorts of social categories that if you were going to do a quantitative study of some sort, you had to somehow or other figure out how to locate them within a class, set of class categories. And there was no really comfortable solution. Typical cases would be managers and professionals. Those are the kind of most stark cases. The Marxian concept of class was at its cleanest, its clearest specification, at a level of abstraction where there were only capitalists and workers. That was the concept of class developed in most of Capital that had a systematic, clear, coherent classification. Workers were all those people in the class structure who had nothing to sell but their labor power, who could be fired by their bosses, who had to look for work. They could not produce their own standard of living without looking for work because they were dispossessed of the means of production. That's the classical polarized capital-labor relation. Well, that's true for most managers. You know, most managers and supervisors, most professionals sell their labor power and they can get fired. And under certain conditions, they can become destitute because they lose their jobs and they don't have any other way of earning a livelihood besides getting another job. And the industries in which they've been located have disappeared and they're forced into bankruptcy and living at a very lower level. So the fact that they earned high incomes didn't seem, from the point of view of the class theory of Marxism, a very relevant criterion for defining them as something other than workers. Yet to have a working class that consisted of all people who worked for wages or salaries seemed to render the concept particularly unuseful in empirical, for most empirical cases. So there was this problem. The problem is what to do with the middle class is the way to kind of describe the problem. The middle class was a term in everyday life. It's still a term used a lot, of course. It's not a term that had any comfortable location, any comfortable status within the Marxian tradition. But still you had to contend with it one way or another. Now, the failure of a simple polarized class concept to do the job, to be good enough for empirical analysis, that failure could mean one of two things. So let's take a really simple case. You're trying to explain political attitudes, orientations, behavior, and you have a really simple class concept. If you work for a wage, you're a worker. So about 85% of the population are workers. If you own your own means of production or live off of capital, you're a capitalist. So then, with a few other little wrinkles, that gives you a capitalist class among the economically active part of the population. That'll give you a capitalist class in the 4 or 5%, a working class in the 85%, and then some hard to classify folks. You know, self-employed people who don't employ anyone. You know, there's a few ambiguous categories. So let's call those the petty bourgeoisie. That's the sort of standard way that Marxists did it. So you plug that into a regression equation and you find that it explains very little variance in the attitudes. So you add to the regression equation a whole bunch of other variables. You add education. You add income. You add other status measures, and you find that your explained variance goes way up, but the class part of your analysis isn't doing much work for you. So one solution is to say class just doesn't explain very much around political attitudes. We have to add all these other processes into the equation. The alternative is to say the problem is with our concept of class. That level of abstraction, the polarized class concepts used in Volume 1 of Capital, is just not the right level of abstraction for studying the specific problem at hand, the formation of political attitudes. What we need is a more concrete concept of class where we don't rely on this simple polarized notions, but we introduce other kinds of complexities. The latter solution is the solution that I went for, and that involved then a project of concept formation. You know, taking the old concept, shaking it up, figuring out how to coherently transform it in a way that enabled it to still function in the abstract theory, so it's being disciplined by its need to function in the abstract theory of Marxist class analysis, has to function in that theory. You make it more concrete, it still has to function in the abstract theory, but it also will have more explanatory power for concrete problems. The way I refer to this is a process of concept formation that has a double discipline to it. It's disciplined by the theory within which it functions, and it's disciplined by the empirical explanatory tasks which it faces. Now that double discipline makes it a very hard process. It's not easy to try new conceptual formations that both have a logically coherent relationship to the more abstract theory, because that means you have to really think about what is the abstract theory, how does its pieces fit together, and how does a change in some more concrete concept remain coherent with it. And you have to have criteria for empirical adequacy. You have to do both things. Most sociologists don't bother with this stuff. Now, most sociology either takes its concepts off the shelf without worrying about them, and only worries about the problem of what's called operationalization. It's a whole separate issue. That's how do you take the conceptual definition and create concrete empirical indicators? How do you go from the theoretical criteria to that's a pragmatic issue. How do you get pragmatic indicators? They worry about that. But But they don't worry very much about the location of that concept within some conceptual field. A good example of this lack of worry, is around, I can give, there's many examples. One would be the category occupation. The category occupation is used all the time in sociology. You'll be hard put to find a systematic theoretical discussion of what exactly defines an occupation, how do we know its boundaries, what makes something split into two occupations rather than one, how should you group occupations into broader occupational categories. A very, very limited discussion of this. You'll have huge amounts of research on social mobility using occupation as the criterion without any discussion of what an occupation is. What's the relationship between occupational categories and jobs? You know, the occupational labels and the actual jobs people do. What happens when a job seems to have the occupational characteristics of several occupations? What happens, for example, when somebody, we consider a manager an occupation, right? That's, if you look in the census, in their occupational listings, managers of all different sorts are considered an occupational category. Some managers are also doing engineering. Some managers are also doing accounting. Is an engineer manager a different occupation from an engineer accountant? Should they be considered engineers first, and then the subcategory of engineers are managerial engineers? Or are they managers first, and a subcategory of managers are engineers? Well, these are classification problems, of course, but they're also conceptual problems. They have to do with how you think about these, the categories themselves. Almost no discussion of that in the sociology of occupations. But that's the issue that I faced when I began my work on class, trying to figure out how to theorize the middle class. What's middle about the middle class? That was really the animating problem that then led to the proliferation of work that I did. I stayed with that problem, you know, for way longer than I would have ever anticipated. You know, when I was a graduate student in the early 70s, I graduated in 1976, I embarked on a class structure project. I figured I did my dissertation on class. I had introduced this concept, contradictory locations within class relations, this particular way of thinking about the problem of the middle class. We'll discuss that, I think, in two lectures, I think. We really look carefully at the middle class. So I introduced this idea of contradictory locations. It was getting a certain amount of attention, and I figured that probably the best thing for me to do in the first part of my career as an assistant professor was to do a big empirical study that really played on that concept. In my dissertation, I had to use data that I hadn't gathered. I was doing secondary analysis of other data in which I was able to get some purchase on the notion of contradictory class locations. But I figured the best thing to do would be for me to conduct my own surveys where I would directly operationalize the concept that I had introduced and use it to tackle a range of different kinds of empirical problems. Also, my closest friend in graduate school, Luca Perrone, with whom I had worked closely on this work on contradictory class locations, he went back to Italy, and we figured the best way for us to be able to see each other was to do a joint research project where we could get funding for international comparative work. The actual birth of the comparative class structure project, which, you know, defined the first half of my career ultimately, that we decided to do that the week he was leaving Berkeley because we figured that would be instrumental for keeping our personal connections thriving. If I had known in 1975, as I was finishing my dissertation, that I wouldn't really finish the class structure project and, you know, publish the final work on it until 1997, you know, that I'd be working on that problem for basically a quarter of a century, more or less. you know, I would have been absolutely horrified. It wasn't what I thought was the most important issues to work on. The stuff that I felt was the most important had to do with the state. The theories of the state was really what I felt we needed. You know, theory of the state and democracy and the contradictions of the capitalist state, that's what I really thought I wanted to work on. This was sort of a detour to deepen some of the foundations for that analysis. Now, there was some advantage to being such, to be so preoccupied with a single problem. And fundamentally, it was the problem of what to do with the middle class. You know, there are various faces of that problem, and it played itself out in various ways. But ultimately, that was what I kept coming back to. There is something to be said with going over and over and over in the face of criticisms, taking the criticisms seriously, trying to respond to them in an authentic way rather than just dismissing them. There's something to be said with being so preoccupied with it. I think my understanding of these issues deepened a lot over the next 22 years. It wasn't the case that I just doggedly pursued the same point without any development. Some people have been, if not annoyed, at least a little dismayed with the fact that I don't stick to my positions. You know, there are several different versions of my approach to classes, because people raise interesting and useful objections, and then I try to respond to them. So, of course, the theoretical posture doesn't remain constant. This is meandering a little bit. It's a good opportunity for me to give, you know, in my role of dispenser of wisdom, right? You know, as an aging sociologist who's been in the trenches. Here's a way to think about your own work. If you're doing work that's going to provoke controversy, so you're going to be on the spot and criticized. People are going to attack the work in various ways. The attackers are often very injudicious, right? They're not subtle in the way they approach it. They don't, with any sincerity, say there's a lot of interesting things, but I think this particular aspect of the work needs a little bit of rethinking because if it was rethought, it would actually strengthen it. They don't say things like that. They'll say things, this is complete bullshit, and the reason is because this completely wrong-headed notion. When actually all they mean actually is, you know, this is really an interesting project. So the question is, how do you respond to this without just driving yourself nuts? Either in the sense of feeling always vulnerable, or the worst thing you can do is to never publish until you feel you're invulnerable. You should, you know, the worst thing for a graduate student and a young academic, and an aging academic for that matter, to do, is to feel that your work has to be invulnerable before you're prepared to share it in the world. So here's two bits of wisdom on this. One is to treat your writing as a conversation rather than an edict. Right? When you write something, it's an invitation to conversation with other people. Now, in an ordinary conversation, if you didn't say anything unless you were so sure that nobody could reply to it, it would be really boring. Right? You want conversations in which you learn from what other people say in response to what you say. You should wait until you get it all right, because you can't get it all right. It's impossible. I know that all of the stuff I've written is filled with flaws. It has to be, because there's no way that I could have some divine purchase on the truth in a way that would make my words have that kind of definitive, authoritative, final say on things. So since I care about getting it right, I therefore have to publish it when I know it's not right. Now, that seems a little weird to some people. If you really care about the truth, I care about the truth even though I don't believe it's ever attainable with certainty. I care about getting things right, but that means a commitment to publishing things before I'm sure it's right. because I value other people's interjections and corrections and the ways I can learn from the dialogue that gets generated by the mistakes I make. Now, that's not an excuse for publishing stuff that's completely wrong-headed. You know, I'm not saying you should publish your first drafts without, or try to publish your, you know, your initial musings. But it does give a different perspective on what it means to be engaged as a writer of scholarly works. Think of it as the opening gambit of a conversation, which you want iterations of, and therefore you expect to get sometimes nasty criticisms because people behave that way, that is, they're involved in a discursive culture where you attack rather than treat it as a collaborative project of improving. So be it, that's the culture. So that's the first thing. The second thing, when you get into these debates, it's very useful to treat your own work as if somebody else had written it. To distance yourself from it. Once you've created it, it's out there. It's a bit of our academic culture. You know, it's an artifact. It's been produced. You happen to have been the author. You can feel good about that. I mean, you should always feel, I hope, pride and accomplishment in getting things published. It is an accomplishment. But once it's out there, it's not yours anymore. It's part of the commons of discussion. And you should try to have the same sort of attitude towards it as you would if a good friend of yours had written it. You know, you may be more invested in it as you would with a friend because you value the person. I hope you value yourselves. But not in this proprietary sense where you feel defensive about ideas, the ideas that you care about. Now, if you can get those two things together, writing is a conversation, and once you produce something, it's in the world. It's not yours anymore, really. It's everyone's. It's part of the commons. So that you don't have to feel so invested in it that you have to defend everything. Then you'll be able to listen to other people better. You'll be able to take in the criticisms and think, okay, well, that's a really tough point. You know, it's really hard. How can I rethink some of the categories in order to make it work better? That's the attitude I've tried to take all along. You know, I'm much clearer about these two points now than I was when I was 27. You know, I'm not saying that I had all this completely thought through right from the start. My mother, who's an academic in high school, did give me some advice, which I used as an aphorism in one of my books, which is, she said, "Ricky, that was my childhood nom de famille." She said, "Ricky, you should learn to write in such a way that your critics always know why they disagree with you." Right, so the idea is, don't sweep anything under the table. You know what's, in the best of cases, you know the flaws in the work better than outsiders because you've grappled and struggled with it. You should tell people what the flaws in the work are. You should make it as transparent as possible so that it'll be easier to improve. You know, a very frustrating experience is when you get attacked for all the wrong reasons, when somebody just rips your stuff to shreds because they don't get it or they are kind of arguing against somebody else and not you. Sometimes that's completely their fault. Other times it's because you haven't made your own position clear enough and you haven't been straightforward enough about where you think you're having to just assert things without foundations. Having to make claims in which you say, "I can't really defend this argument. This is the best I can do." Those are the attitudes to take, I think, in the process of both concept formation and theory construction. And, you know, more or less that's what I've tried to do throughout. So there are some things that I think you can see in the way I lay these arguments out. Most of the things I write contain sections where I say unresolved problems, where I try to make explicit what I don't get, where the gaps are, you know, rather than to write as some people. And I think the people in the Marxian tradition, because they often feel so embattled, often are particularly guilty of this, they write as if they have answers to everything. That's much more the kind of intellectual stance of theologians than it is of social should be of social theorists, who shouldn't write as if they have the answer to everything, because they don't. And anybody who pretends they do is trying to pull the wool over your eyes. Well, okay, that's all stage setting for this discussion. I haven't, nobody's raised their hand, but I'm sure you've got some thoughts around the stage setting part of the discussion. Any questions anyone wants to raise? All right, I'll forge ahead, but not only is writing an invitation to conversation, speaking is even more an invitation to, as it were, conversation is an invitation to conversation. Lecturing has this peculiar social form, right? Because we've all been to countless lectures, certainly by the time you're in a class like this. And lecturing is, by convention, monologic rather than dialogic. So we're all in that mode of reception of listeners rather than conversationalists when you hear lectures. When you're having an actual conversation and somebody lectures at you, you know how annoying that is, because you don't feel you can get a word in edgewise. It's therefore awkward from a kind of cultural point of view for a lecturer to insist that what the lecture is actually meant to be a conversation, because all of the trappings of the event and the privileged position of the speaker as lecturer undermines and contradicts the professed claim that what this is really a conversation. So I understand the habitus. This is a Bourdieu point. Another little digression. I don't know why I feel in a digressionary mood. Another little digression. So one of the core concepts of Pierre Bourdieu, for those of you who haven't studied it, is the notion of habitus. Habitus means a set of protocols, basically, that have become so internalized that you are incredibly comfortable in the interactions and mutual expectations involved in such interactions. It becomes second nature. Sometimes he uses the expression, you have a feel for the game, you know, the way an athlete does. An athlete who plays soccer and has been doing it for decades and really knows the game doesn't have to think about the offsides rule, the way you switch from one foot to the other to avoid an interception and so on. It's all sort of hardwired. It's embodied. And the notion of it embodied is really right. It's in your body. You feel it. And lecturing is like that. So I was invited to give a lecture series in Paris about 5 or 6 years ago by the Maison des Hautes Etudes en Sciences Sociales, it's basically the Institute for Social Science, High Studies of Social Science, I guess. It was a 4-part lecture. The person who invited me explained that he couldn't come to the first lecture because he had an unbreakable other obligation. So I show up in the lecture room at 5 to 4, it's a 4 o'clock lecture. And there's one person in the hall. And I wait. It's 10 after. So I ask the person, my French is pretty good, I ask if am I in the wrong place? And he says, no, this is the place of the lecture. Apparently it had been terribly advertised. And the way it works in France is that the professor who invites somebody has the responsibility of recruiting an audience. And he didn't do it. So there's this one person in the audience. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to still give the lecture. You made the trouble to come. I'm very appreciative. But I found it impossible to lecture to a single person. It was physically uncomfortable. It really was a Bourdieusian moment. It was physically uncomfortable because it was violating the mutual expectations of that cultural form, which I was so practiced at. that I became incredibly self-conscious about the task at hand. And this person was turned out to be very shy, and and so I said, "Well, let's just talk about it." And that was just a terrible moment. All right, and enough digression. Yes.
Just from reading what you've written and then talking about that review by Russell Jacoby, your writing's not very polemical, which is not a usual Marxist stance, it seems. So I was just wondering what your position on the polemic is.
Yeah. So, I don't know how many of you have read Russell Jacoby's diatribe against envisioning real utopias. He just dismisses the whole book completely as harmful. I mean, his basic view is that it would have been better if it hadn't been written. That's really what he says. It's not just that he feels it has certain flaws. Now, he objects to the whole genre of this kind of writing. For a whole set of reasons. I don't know him personally. When I read the review, it was harder in a review like that to feel the distance that I, support in thinking about these things. It felt much more like being the subject of road rage. If somebody gets out of their car with a red face and yells at you, it's upsetting. You're shaken by it. And I felt assaulted, really, by that review, in a way that I was surprised at how hard it was for me to distance myself from it. Rather than regarding this as a kind of weird spectacle that was a public performance in which he was behaving badly, and that I felt much more under siege by it than by any other review I'd ever gotten. His stance is that writing is a warfare. The object is to defeat opponents, to humiliate. Clearly that was part of his objective. A very primitive view about intellectual matters. I am personally opposed to mobilizing strong emotion of that sort in writing. I have perhaps delusional faith in the Enlightenment with the idea that reason is the basis by which we can advance our understanding of the world, and that it should be the weight of the best argument that advances our knowledge, and that using rhetorical tricks to strengthen your argument is actually illegitimate. Now, I don't mean by that it's possible to write without passion. I'm not talking about sterile writing. I do think that there's a role for passion, for showing the emotional seriousness with the emotions that render what you're doing serious. So I do, I think there are some places in Real Utopia, in the Real Utopias book, where I express the emotional character of my commitments, that they're not just ideas that I hold, but they're ideas that I really care about. So there are places where I will write in a way that communicates that. But I still keep even that fairly subdued, because I want the reader to be able to respond to the ideas in as reflexive and thoughtful and understanding a way. And if you infuse a lot of emotion into the writing and use trigger words and heavy symbolism that raises the temperature, I think that interferes with it. It's why writing that has the character of denouncing even views that I find very pernicious, that has the character of denouncing them, I don't think is the optimal way of advancing understanding.
I was kind of just thinking about Jan Elster's what he would say about this, and thinking about academic
That's a very nice point. Yeah. Yeah, an assurance game is a form of interaction in which there's a high level of trust, and everyone wants the cooperative solution, but to get to the cooperative solution, everybody has to trust everybody. And in a way, that's what solidarity is. When we discuss class formation, that's what we're going to focus on, is thinking of solidarity as an assurance game, in effect, as a form of what's also called conditional altruism. And I think academic life should, that's what it aspires to. It's also what science in general aspires to. Science in general aspires to a view where the best argument wins, because it's the most reasoned, meaning coherent plus evidence. I think that should be the standard for academic discourse as well. But of course, academic life is embedded in a competitive world where there are all sorts of extrinsic stakes to academic debates. There are positions in universities, there are grants and fellowships, there's prizes of all sorts. So there's all these rewards that are available, and if the strategy of your work is primarily oriented towards getting those rewards, sometimes the non-collegial, non-solidaristic form of interaction has advantages. And some people are really good at that. And some academic cultures foster that more than others. The American academic context culture is actually pretty civilized in these respects. The kind of invective that Jacobi had is much more common in Britain than in the US, and even more on the continent. In France, slaying your opponent is considered good sport. Bourdieu said sociology is a martial art. He saw it as street fighting, basically, rather than collaborative, collective searching for improvements in our knowledge. Other thoughts on these prologue themes? All right. So look, there's so class is a context for looking at concept formation. There are two sorts of ways of approaching this. The one way of approaching the problem of concept formation is to try to clarify what are the lines of demarcation between different kinds of class concepts. So one problem we have is that the word class, that specific word gets deployed in all sorts of different contexts by different theoretical traditions for different purposes. So one task is to figure out, in this big spectrum of possible uses, what defines the specificity of the Marxian concept? How do we differentiate the Marxian concept from other concepts? That's what this first block of the course is. Of the lecture, alternative class concepts. What are the different kinds of questions for which class is the answer? And these different kinds of questions then are embedded in different theoretical agendas. Now, different theories ask more than one question, so that's why this gets to be a kind of complicated and interesting way of approaching it. In the chapter in alternative, or whatever that, the book was originally going to be called "If Class Is the Answer, What Is the Question?" But Cambridge University Press said that long titles don't sell books, and they also have an aversion to cute titles. I still think that would have been a better title for Approaches to Class Analysis, I guess is what it's called, right? Yeah. I think it would have been better if it was call the classes the answer, what is the question. But that ended up being the title for the concluding chapter of the book. So that was my my last general approach. Well, no, actually, that was my most comprehensive approach to trying to slot all the different uses of class into some overarching framework, was that chart where I have the different theoretical traditions and the different questions. And then my argument was that theoretical traditions anchor their concept in one particular question. So there's one question which defines the whole motivation for the theoretical framework. And then there are other questions which get tied to that anchoring question. Then, so that's one way of laying out the demarcations between the Marxian concept of class and others. And the other way, which was in my subsequent article published in New Left Review, Understanding Class, in that article I argue that actually another way you can think about different class concepts is that they each identify a different specific kind of class mechanism, that a full bore class analysis shouldn't feel compelled to identify with only one or another of these mechanisms, that all these are real mechanisms in the world. They're all discoveries of mechanisms, causal processes in the world that bear on the phenomena we're studying. But that different class frameworks can be more or less encompassing. The Marxian framework, I argued, has the advantage that the Weberian mechanisms are included within it, whereas Weberian class analysis excludes the Marxian mechanisms. The Marxian framework, therefore, in a sense, is the more comprehensive one. And the other approaches to class analysis can be thought of as more limited because they restrict the number or kinds of mechanisms which can be included. So let's let me just briefly go through the first of these tasks, the first of these approaches, alternative class concepts as answers to different kinds of questions. I tried, when I laid this out, this was another one of these iterative processes. The first talks I gave under the heading, if class is the answer, what is the question? The very first ones, I think, had four questions. And by the time I published the book, I had gotten up to seven. I don't know if that's an exhaustive list. We can think of, I'm sure, other questions for which class is an answer. I'm not sure if there are other questions which anchor any traditions of class analysis. So, yeah. Oh, yes. Where's the, yeah. Anybody else need a? Okay. So if class is the answer, what is the question? First question is, how do people classify themselves in a system of social stratification? That's a question you might want to ask. There are many different ways that people in different times and places will subjectively understand how they fit into the social structure, and in particular into a social structure of inequalities. So, of course, social stratification is only one of the ways people fit themselves into a social structure. People may also fit themselves into a social structure on the basis of ethnic identity, which need not imply stratification. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But class is one of the ways that people locate themselves subjectively. And therefore, one kind of definition of class is a subjective identification of a person as a member of a group within a hierarchical system of economic inequalities. But it's the subjective identification which becomes the key concept. Subjective location is a cultural category that helps to explain various kinds of behaviors, and solidarities that people have. But in this, when that is used as the anchoring question, there's no assumption of any kind of correspondence between the subjective locations that people form themselves in and objective groups of actors with common interests. There's no assumption of any kind of isomorphism between the subjective categories and an objective one. The second common question is not about subjectivity, but about people's objective location. How are people located objectively in distributions of material inequality? Now, this is actually the dominant way that the term class is used in the United States in popular culture. When politicians talk about middle class tax cuts, all that they mean are tax cuts for people in the middle of the income distribution. And income distribution is taken as a kind of first approximation of where you're located in the distribution of material inequality. So it's really people who are living in the middle of the distribution of material conditions of life. But it's a distributional notion, and it's not meant to have precise boundaries. There's no sense in which the question, what's the middle class, has any non-arbitrary boundary to it in a distributional notion. It simply means people who are in the middle of the distribution as opposed to at the tails. And then there's, when you have this kind of class as distributional location, then you have all sorts of other terms you use to indicate that ambiguity. You have upper middle and lower middle. And you can even have, lower upper. I mean, the lower upper class has not ever been a term of popular usage, but it's a natural term within a distributional notion of class. So if that's the question you want to ask, how are people located objectively in distributions of material inequality, and you want a term that will capture broad categories within a system of distribution, then the term middle class is an appropriate term for capturing that idea. The third question would be something like this. To what extent do different empirical dimensions of social inequality coincide in ways which constitute empirically distinguishable groups? So in this perspective, you have a whole variety of dimensions of inequality in a society. You have income inequality, wealth inequality, education inequality, status inequality, housing inequality, precariousness inequality, risk inequality. You know, you can list as many as you like. And the question is, do these dimensions hang together? Or are they all cross-cutting and more or less random, so that knowing that a person is high on one tells you virtually nothing about where they will be on another? So if it were the case, for example, that the insecurity of life was unassociated with your income, so that high-income people had just as much insecurity as a low-income person, that they were as much at risk of having catastrophes happen to them that would, you know, kind of completely wreck their economic situation, then the argument here would be that's less of a class structure than if these things are associated. So if education, income, wealth, status, and risk all tend to cluster together, that indicates that the system of stratification has a class-like character to them. And the more it structures together, the more you can really distinguish groups. Groups in the sense of actors who share all of these characteristics. Class as an empirical summary of stratification, therefore, corresponds to the view that the classness of a system of inequality is variable. a system of inequality has a high level of classness when you do a factor analysis on these various definite dimensions, you get clear factors where all these things group together. And in the ideal kind of class as a summary of stratification, you get bimodal distributions. You know, it's not just that there's a correlation between these dimensions, but there tends to be polarization between them. So you'll have lots of people with zero wealth and a few people with lots of wealth. But it's not a normal distribution. You know, it's a bimodal distribution. You get huge numbers of people at the bottom with a lot of wealth and some people who have a fair amount of wealth, but it's not peaked in the middle of the distribution. The same with job security. You'll have a lot of people who live completely precarious lives and a fair number of people with pretty secure jobs, creating this sort of bimodal distribution. So the more bimodal the distribution is, the more it's a class structure. And the more all these dimensions hang together, the more it's a class structure. This is what could be called an empiricist definition of class. That is, it's simply a term that's being used as a way of simplifying a complex array of multidimensional space. The multidimensional space is really where the action is. That's where all the causal processes lie. And when they cluster together, that's a convenient summary. And then there may be arguments that their clustering together suggests that they are structured in a systematic way, co-structured, and therefore class is the way of talking about it. Yeah?
So when you say they're structured, you mean that there's some there's some actor that is enforcing that structure? Or?
No, it doesn't. There's no implication that this is the result of some collective actor that has designed it this way. It does usually imply that there are rules of the game. There are institutions that bring these different mechanisms into alignment. So the typical mechanism that's thought to link high education with high income is the labor market. So high education gives you privileged access to high-paying jobs. And the link between education, income, and wealth is that high wealth in your family makes it more likely that you'll get high education, and high income means you have discretionary earnings that you can turn into wealth. So that the education, income, wealth nexus, that clustering of mechanisms, these are separate ideas, education, income, and wealth, but the reason why they group together is because on the one hand we have a market for jobs, and on another hand, we have a process for getting access to education. And on the third hand, as it were, we have a system by which high income can be turned into assets. And those three things work together as a system such that you'll get a clustering of those positions. Okay. Let's take our break and then come back to the market opportunity structure argument. Let's continue. I'm going to go through the rest of this part more quickly because I want to get to part four, which is, I think, the part that's not as available in any of the things that you've read. So we have seven of these different questions which the concept of class is meant to answer, and different bodies of work in class analysis get anchored in one or more of these questions. We did three. Let me, even though the remaining four are the more theoretically rich ones, but let me just specify them without going into any elaboration. What determines the basic life chances of individuals in a market society? That's the classic Weberian question. And the answer, class determines the basic life chances of individuals in a market society. That answer means that class is a way of talking about the market opportunity structure. Class becomes a way of talking about how different people enter the market with different opportunities. So Weber's market opportunity structure notion of class focuses on the way in which people bring different sorts of resources to markets, which give them different bargaining powers, different opportunities for income, and different life chances in this broader sense. What forms of conflict are most systematically linked to the social organization of production? What forms of conflict? That's closely linked to the previous question, class as a market opportunity structure, because people bringing different resources into a market, that's also one of the things which helps explain the forms of conflict they have. But it's a different framing of the agenda. It's asking a question about what generates conflicts in economic structures rather than just what generates opportunities in economic structures. How should we characterize and explain the variations across history in the social organization of inequalities? Well, that's a very different kind of question. This is not asking how do we locate individuals within particular structures, but how do we differentiate systems of inequality across time and place? It's asking about the variation in the very system of inequality. And class is one of the ways of identifying that historical variation. Finally, what sorts of transformations are needed to eliminate economic oppression and exploitation within capitalist societies? Now, that's obviously a wholly different kind of question. It's a question that, at its core, has a normative component. What kinds of transformations are needed to eliminate oppression and exploitation? Economic oppression and exploitation in capitalist societies. And the answer is that you have to transform the class structure. Well, class then is a way of identifying what the causal processes that generate economic exploitation and oppression. Class is a way of identifying what needs transforming in order for those conditions to be eliminated. That's the anchor for the Marxian concept. Okay, that's one way of approaching this whole agenda of how do we give specificity to the concept of class, how in the Marxist tradition, how do we build up such a concept? When I revisited all of these issues most recently, it seemed to me another way of giving specificity was to think of class as rooted in a variety of different mechanisms, and different traditions of class analysis simply focused on different mechanisms. A comprehensive, unified class analysis then tries to understand the interconnections among these mechanisms. And in these terms, it seems to me, there are three broad kinds of mechanisms which are linked to class. When I say linked to class, I mean that people who use the word class are using the word in connection with these three sorts of causal processes. I think the article which is in the readings, Understanding Class Analysis, lays this out pretty clearly. So I will just mention it here and then get on to the conceptual foundations of the Marxist concept itself. So first, the simplest kind of mechanism linked to class is that class identifies individual attributes and conditions of life. When you're locating a person in a class structure, what you're trying to do is locate that person with respect to a set of individual attributes and conditions of life which affect their lives. The key idea here is that you can specify these attributes of persons for each person separately. It doesn't have anything to do with their relationship to others. So you can define a person as poor, as living in destitution, just by establishing what their caloric intake is, what their housing conditions are. You might need to know something about their relative poverty. That is, to know that a person is destitute, you need to know if they're in a rich society or in a hunting and gathering society. You know, the nature of the overall distribution might be relevant information in order to fully define those conditions, but you don't need to know anything about their relationship to other people. So this first kind of mechanism are mechanisms which are directly attached to persons, either attached to them in the sense that they carry those attributes with them, or attached to them in the sense that you're identifying exactly what the conditions of life that they have are. The second kind of mechanism is identified with the expression opportunity hoarding. This is a relational concept of class. In order to know that a person is hoarding opportunities, you have to know something about their relationship to others. The Weberian notion of class as life chances in a market only makes sense in the context of buyers and sellers of commodities. And you have to know the relationship among people within a market in order to know what it means to hoard an opportunity or not. And finally, class as exploitation and domination identifies people by their ongoing relationships of activity, not just their relationships of exchange. Both exploitation and domination involve the way in which people control the lives of others, not simply the ways in which people exclude others from access to resources. In a sense, then, as you move from this first mechanism to the third, the relational depth of the mechanisms becomes ever greater. Yeah? All of these mechanisms are tied up with the lives of individuals, even if the mechanisms are enforced by some kind of collective process. So to describe a social relationship as exploitative or to describe a relationship as domination implies that there are people dominating others. The relation of domination may be enforced and institutionalized by a set of collective processes, but it is still people dominating people. That's in play in a domination relationship. So these are three different kinds of mechanisms. They become relationally deeper. Exploitation and domination involve the way in which the lives of people are interconnected in ways in which the lives of some are controlled by the lives of others, where there's an actual interdependence of their ongoing activities. Whereas class as opportunity hoarding, the relations are relations of exclusion and monopoly. People are being excluded from access to resources, but there's no ongoing relationship between them. That's part of the definition of exclusion. And in the individual attributes, you get relationally very thin because you can specify these attributes just by describing the individual persons. All of these are mechanisms which impact the lives of people and the structures in which they live, and a full-blown class analysis should, I think, incorporate all of them. And again, the reason why the Marxian broad agenda is the richest one for class analysis is because it encompasses all three, whereas standard stratification views of class analysis never talk about exploitation or domination, and often don't really talk about opportunity hoarding either. the typical view in American sociology about poverty, for example, that, you know, it's not that everybody holds this view, is that we observe that poor people are badly educated. If we could educate poor people adequately, if we could get rid of their deficits in human capital, we would eliminate poverty. Now, that argument identifies the causal process which is most central to the poverty of the poor, being that they have a deficit in some attribute, which the middle class and the rich don't have. They lack human capital. That's also the economist's view. If we can repair that deficit, then we'll solve the problem. Now, there is, in the sociological analysis, an account for why they have bad education, which is social. That is, it can be because of racism. It can be because of a particular kind of relationship between the state and society, where the state treats education acquisition as an individual responsibility rather than a collective responsibility. So you might have a fully social and political account for the failure of individuals to get their attributes. You need not blame the victim. It need not be an account that says the poor are poor because they're badly educated and it's their fault. You can say the poor are poor because they're badly educated and it's the society's fault. You can even say the poor are poor because they're badly educated and it's the fault of those with privilege. So you can even attribute the deficit to the bad behavior, the selfish behavior of privileged segments of the population. But nevertheless, the causal mechanism, which is pivotal, is still lodged in the attributes of persons. That's very different from saying the poor are poor because the rich need poor people. Right? It's to the advantage of the rich to have poor people because then they can exploit them. Or even stronger, it's a necessary consequence of the rich being rich that there are poor people, because if there weren't poor people, the rich wouldn't be rich. That is, their wealth comes from the extraction of surplus from the poor. That's a wholly different kind of argument. It says that it has nothing to do, in principle, with the attributes of the poor. Now, a class analysis that emphasizes exploitation and domination would say, if somehow or other we massively improve the education of the poor, this would be a good thing. That mechanism does exist. It would reduce the degree of marginalization of the poor. But unless we changed other attributes of the society, what it would mean is that educational requirements for entry-level jobs would just go up. It would not mean that we would be generating an egalitarian distribution of income. It would probably reduce inequalities. Of course, what it would take to fully educate the poor would require a very substantial change in the balance of forces politically, which would have all sorts of other consequences. But even if we kind of bracket that issue, if we massively educated the poor, it would probably produce some positive labor market effects, but it would not change the fundamental relationship between the owners of capital and the providers of labor services to them, nor eliminate the exploitative mechanisms which generate inequalities in outcomes independently of the degree of education that people have. Yeah?
I was curious. In the review piece, it seemed like we were reading Bourdieu as being mostly about the first and second types of analysis.
Right.
Is that right? That
yeah.
You don't see the sort of exploitation?
Right. I don't see any relational exploitation taking place in Bourdieu. Now, it may be that there, you know, I haven't read Bourdieu thoroughly enough. There may be places in passing where that is discussed, but it doesn't figure in Distinction, which is as big as his major book on class. And even domination in the sense of the control of one group over another, as opposed to their positioning themselves relative to others and excluding them from access to the privileged positions. But the domination in the sense of bossing people around doesn't really figure very much in Bourdieu. And that's why I felt he was more in the first and second categories. Okay. But let's turn now to this conceptual foundations of the Marxist class analysis. What I've presented here is a kind of step-by-step building up of the concept. So now this is less a question of differentiating Marxist concepts from others, and more asking how do we build up from first principles the Marxist concept itself. And this is sort of my roadmap for how to do that. The first step is to really get this idea of social relation. So the core, you know, if there's just one central bottom line starting point in the Marxian, in the family of class concepts that all have a Marxian character, it would be to say that these are all relational categories. Class is a social relation in Marx. It's not a position, it's not a status, it's not an attribute, it's a social relation. And here then the way to characterize the contrast is that class is a relational concept, not a gradational concept. The idea of a social relation is not a simple idea. This is a term that you hear all the time. The first day you take sociology, you hear the term social relation. It's actually a pretty slippery notion. It's the building block notion, I think, of sociology, social relation. But it's a pretty slippery notion. One of the things that's slippery about it is the following. When you talk about a social relation, what is it that are being related? To use some Latin, what are the relata of a social relation? The relata are that which are related through the relation, as it were. Social relations bind together something. It is a social relation, but what is it that are bound together? Now, one idea is that it's people, concrete flesh and blood human beings, are the things related in social relations. That is clearest when we talk about interpersonal relations. So when you talk about the relationship between friends or parents and children, it's very easy to see, yes, you see the iconic mom and dad and kid as real people, and then you kind of draw a little line connecting them with maybe arrows going in each direction to show that they're interacting. And you sort of think of what's being related are the actual people. But there's an alternative view, an alternative way of thinking about this, which is what renders this all slippery, is that what's being related are not actual people. What's being related in a relation are roles, to use one sociological term, or practices, to use another kind of term. So that it's mothering and childing, as it were, that are being related. It's professorializing and studenting. I mean, what's being related here are the practices of being in our classroom, the practices that we define as the practices of the professor role, has a social relation to the practices of being a student. The practices meaning purposeful activities, engaged in relations. So it's also true that I'm a flesh and blood person, as are you. But the actual relation is not so much binding us together. That's a shorthand for binding our activities together. Right? And the activities occur within relations. The activities don't occur willy-nilly. The activities are all relational. To even talk about the activities of a worker is to talk about the activities of a capitalist. Now, when you think about it this way, that it's the practices which are being connected. The practices. Practices are a way of talking about activities. I mean, there's a lot of, as in all of this stuff, there's all these different words that get used. They're all trying to get at the same sort of thing. Slight nuances. There are reasons we will see later why the word practice has a certain purchase, why it's a good word for this. But basically, it's a way of talking about activity. Or actions, that's another term. Actions, activities, practices. These are all related, closely related ideas. But it's the activities, actions, practices that are the relata of relations. And the persons then are the kind of enactors of these actions. Or to use a very suspect term, they're the bearers of these practices. So I am the bearer of professorial practices in the social relationship of the classroom. I'm enacting them. Now, in the extreme version, that makes it seem like I've got it. There's a script, and I've learned the script, and I'm following the script. So that the notion of purposes and conscious intentionality becomes marginalized. In some social theory, that's by design. Other times, it's just a byproduct of the way people talk about it. So all of this is to say that this very initial step is not actually such an easy step, to say class is a social relation. I tend to think that that it is pretty useful to keep in mind that what is being related are activities. And of course, activities are performed by real people. So these aren't disembodied activities. I don't like the notion that the person is nothing other than the bearer of these practices. That doesn't capture the relationship between persons and practices properly, which is an issue we will be discussing, especially in our discussion of ideology. That's the pivot of the problem of ideology, is how to think about the relationship between persons and the things they do, their practices. Because ideology is the way of tapping into the subjective aspect of being a person with respect to the practices in which we engage. All this makes all of this murky and difficult. But as a starting point, I think the best way to do it, whenever you hear the word social relation, remember what's being related are human practices, activities, actions. I don't think it matters which of those words you use for this purpose. But that's really the relata of social relations, our practices. And then for shorthand, you can say it's persons. You know, as long as you keep that idea in mind, that it's not just the biological entity. It's not the physical being that's in a relation. It's the physical being as the performer of a set of practices within the relation. Okay, that's the first step. Second step is, well, class relations are social relations, but what kind of social relation? And here, we have to understand that there are all sorts of different sorts of social relations which need to be differentiated. And then the question is, how do we differentiate them? So I have a list here. I didn't list them in the outline. You know, class relations are different from gender relations. Gender relations are different from race relations. Race relations are different from friendship relations. So that's a nice set of four: friends, races, genders, classes, class relations, gender relations, race relations, friendship relations. If we want a full relational sociology, we have to know how to distinguish one from another. And sometimes they overlap in ways that makes it quite confusing. Sometimes class relations look like race relations, but they're actually what's going on is the class relational aspect. And the race aspect is simply reinforcing the class aspect. It's not really an autonomous, separate, completely independent relationship. Slavery in the United States in the pre-Civil War period, I think, is a class relation. It's a distinctive way by which surplus is extracted from one group of people by another. It's enforced through a set of harsh, repressive mechanisms and supported by a range of ideological and cultural forms. But slavery is a class relation. Now, it turned out in a bourgeois society that it's very convenient, if you're going to have slavery, it's awfully convenient to racialize it. that a racialized form of slavery is a much more stable form of slavery than a non-racial slavery would be. If there was an attempt early on to have indentured servants that were white, and it was very hard to reproduce it. It was extremely unstable. It was very easy for the white indentured servants to, once there was enough settlement around, for them to run away and melt into the urban areas and escape the terms of their servitude. Now, indentured servants and black slaves initially, in the very early years of the colonies, had exactly the same legal status. The only difference being was that the indentured servant had a contract for, was only a slave for 7 years, whereas the slave was indefinitely a slave. But there wasn't any other difference between them in the very initial ones. That was a really unstable set of relations. And essentially through a trial and error process, it was discovered that if you're going to have slavery, you might as well just make it African slaves, color code the slaves, classify them as subspecies, give them an ideological status of children, not fully rational, needing the protection of civilized whites, etc. You could create a whole cultural form that would help to stabilize this relation. Yeah?
But what was the impetus to bring in external labor that, like, in the organization of society that existed pre, the shipping of slaves to
right.
America? What was the impetus then?
Cheap, exploitable labor. The motivation for slavery was unequivocally straight economic. There was no motive. I think anyone who feels that the motivation for it was racial, you know, that the white population wanted to have a subjected population to racially lord over, it's kind of an absurd view that the motivations weren't racial. The motivations were strictly economic. They wanted to have a cheap, highly exploitable labor supply. And this was a way you could do it. And the power relations were such that you could get away with it. And they had collaborators in Africa. You know, there was a slave trade already existing in Africa. They could plug into networks that already had slave raids. There were slave traditions and of a very different sort that was produced in the New World, but nevertheless provided the raw materials for a New World form of slavery. And the racialization of it, that is the melding together of two kinds of relationships, was in the service of class. To me, any other account of that just doesn't make sense. Nevertheless, once established, the racialized aspect of it develops its own relational properties, and race as a social relation becomes very deeply embedded in the social structure and in the cultural forms that accompany it. So it's certainly not the case that once you have racialized slavery, that simply eliminating slavery eliminates race. No, the racial aspects have an autonomy, and this is partially what we'll be talking about in the race-class question. So we have different kinds of social relations. In every case, though, the relata of these relations are practices. There are different kinds of practices which are being related. So gender practices are not the same as class practices, which is why we give them a different name. If some people argue, and this is a theme we'll talk about in the class gender discussion, our very brief class gender discussion, some people say that you can't separate out class and gender, that the forms of interaction are so deep that all class relations are gendered and all gendered relations are classed. If that's really true, you can't separate them out, then we shouldn't have two words for it. We should have a single word, clender. That is, if it is indeed the case that this is one indissolvable relation that we confusedly separate out as class relations and gender relations, if that is the right way to think about it, then our language isn't capturing the nature of the mechanisms involved, but we have our clender relations, and we engage in clender practices. Now, I don't think that makes sense, and I don't think anybody does. You know, I don't think people who argue for the indissolvability of class and gender actually believe that, which means I think they're operating under the actual models that they're operating under say that there are class relations and gender relations, and they deeply intertwine and affect each other. But the "and they" is important because it implies that these are separable mechanisms that have their own logics, their own tendencies, contradictions, and conditions of existence. All right. We now then have to say, what are these relations that we call class relations? To do this, I think we need to first have a notion of the relations of production, and then the idea of class relations as one possible form of production relations. So not all relations of production have to be class relations. Class relations are one way, one type of production relation. So first, step 2A is a concept of relations of production. And this concept, I think, should be developed in the following way. So this is, again, my recipe, my step-by-step guide. Step one is the simple observation that in any form of production, assets have to be deployed in various ways. There are tools, there are raw materials, there's land. Maybe you want to include skills. Maybe you want to include labor as an asset. Maybe not. You have to decide. What's the list of assets that get deployed in production? The deployment can be described in a variety of ways. You have all these different things that go into production. You can describe them in all sorts of ways. One description is a technical description. In economics, that's called a production function. So you can have a technical engineering description. You have to have so many hours of labor of such and such a skill using these tools in that way with this raw material to produce that much output, in which the labor inputs interact in the following sequence. You know, it's like a cookbook to tell you how to prepare a meal. So that's one way, a technical description. Now, the technical description, you should note, does have some social relations in it. That is, it may be that in the technical description of how you build something, you say two people need to pick up either end of a large timber and move it from point A to point B. Now, the fact that you've invoked two people and they have to do it at the same time and they need to see each other so that they don't bump into things, that's a description of a social relation. They are social beings and they're communicating. But I think it's best thinking of that as a technical description of the production process. It doesn't say anything about one of them bossing the other. There's no necessary conditions of domination or anything like that between them. It's just a technical description of how they must interact their activities in order to accomplish the task. We can also, however, describe how these assets get deployed in terms of the rights and powers of actors. So we can describe these as describing the deployment of the assets in terms of the social relations of production rather than the technical relations of production. Jerry Cohen, or the material relations of production. Jerry Cohen makes that distinction between material relations and social relations. And I think it's a useful distinction. You know, it's one of these uses of terms that can be confusing a bit, but when he talks about two laborers physically coordinating the movement of a large piece of wood so that they don't bump into each other, he describes those as material relations of production, not social relations of production. Normally we would say they're also social because everything is social, but I think it's a useful distinction. We can describe the relations of production, the deployment of these assets in relational terms, in terms of the rights and powers of the actors. The rights and powers of the actors over assets are really rights and powers over each other. Now, this is an important thing to note. If we say that someone owns the tools, what that means is they have the power to exclude other people from using it. And that's all it means. That is, the right over a thing is entirely a specification of the relationship between people over the use of that thing. It actually has nothing directly to do, so to speak, with the direct relationship of the person to the thing. As the use of the term rights or powers or ownership, all of these social relational terms with respect to assets are all about the relations between people. Social relations of production become class relations when these rights and powers over the assets used in production are unequally distributed. That's the simplest way, I think, to understand the notion of class relations. So class relations are social relations of production when the rights and powers over the use of all of the different assets of production, those rights and powers are unequally distributed, where some people have rights and powers that other people lack. When you have unequal distributions of rights and power over the use of the means of production, when that is true, you have one type or another of class relations. The next step is to, which we'll do on Wednesday, is variations of class relations. So we'll begin on Wednesday with step 3 under Roman numeral 2. Okay?